Aaron Long, thank you for being with us, sir. I'm really excited to have you on.
Of course, man. Thanks for having me.
Well, where are you in this moment right now?
I am in Jersey City. I'm in my apartment on lockdown at the moment.
Okay. So we can obviously spend time talking about what we're dealing with, but I think a lot of us are already sick of talking about that. So let's get into the good of this interview. Tell me where you're from. You grew up in California, Southern Cal. Some will say it's not Southern Cal. I know it's a little ribbon going on.
Yeah, I'm from Hesperia, Oak Hills, California. So that's probably an hour and a half outside of LA. So all the guys that grew up like Sasha, like in the heart of it, you know, love to take little jabs at me saying that I'm not from Southern California. But I was making that drive in there to play in those clubs like Arsenal as a kid, making that hour drive in 2-3 times a week with my mom. I've born and raised in SoCal.
That's more Victorville. Is that San Bernardino, Victorville area?
That is very close to Victorville, yes. San Bernardino is probably a 20-minute drive.
Yeah, because I grew up in Las Vegas and come down to LA a lot, so I've done that desert drive.
Yep. Yeah, you passed right by me then.
Yeah. All right, so tell me what it was like growing up for you. Obviously, we all have our stories. Southern Cal has a plethora of football players. It's obviously one of the most difficult places in the nation to try to come up. How was it for you?
Yeah, it was good. I think I started in a pretty small market in the desert, and then soon wanted to start going down the hill, you know, towards, you know, Ontario and LA and train with those teams. When I finally linked up with Arsenal, I was probably like, I would say 11 or 12 years old. That's when I really started getting serious. Kind of had to make the choice between soccer and all the other sports that I was playing at the time. It was started consuming, you know, family time, you know, my mom driving me an hour and a half to training 2-3 times a week. So it was a big sacrifice my family made, and I'm just happy that everybody backed me and supported me through that.
You said you played other sports. What other sports did you play growing up?
Everything, man. My parents put me in everything, basketball, football. I played football in high school, my senior year, actually. I was a cornerback and a kicker. I ran track in high school. I played tennis in high school. So I was kind of all around, bouncing around.
You obviously excelled at soccer. Was there any other sport that you thought you maybe would have had a future in?
I was good at everything. I was definitely a well-rounded athlete, but the only thing that I think that I could have took professionally would probably be kicking for football. Even though I only kicked for 1 year in my senior year, I had some college scouts at trainings and stuff, and they were looking at me.
What was your long in high school?
I think it was only 42 in a game, but in trainings, you know, when their scouts there, they would put me back to 50, 52, and, you know, I can hit a couple through the
other. You think you could do that today? We always see, because listen, I'm a huge football fan. I'm sure you're a football fan as well, fantasy football. And every time we see a kicker miss, the first thing comes out of our mouth is, I could have done that.
I mean, we can, for sure. We can hit the distance and we can nail it through the uprights. But with the pressure and the atmosphere of those games, I'm not going to be the one to be like, yeah, I can do it, no problem. Because I don't know what those guys are thinking in those moments.
What's the difference between kicking a football at practice, if I just go out there like in my shorts and my cleats, and then actually putting the pads on? Is there an actual difference?
There is. Yeah, the pads are pretty restricting. I know kickers wear minimal pads, but it's still restricting. The helmet's a little bit stifling, you know, when you look out of that view. It's definitely tougher for sure.
All right. Well, talk to me about when you're growing up, as you're falling in love with this game. Obviously, you're a lot younger than I was. When I was growing up, there wasn't that much soccer to consume on TV. You had a lot more options. You could have chosen to support any team, and yet you chose to support Arsenal. So I'm a little confused.
Yeah, well, I played for Arsenal. That was my club team from 13 to all the way through the academy. So probably like 18 until I went to college. So, you know, it was pretty easy to just be wearing the jersey every weekend and, you know, playing for Cal South and be like, yeah, you know, I play for Arsenal. I support Arsenal. It was a really easy transition for me.
Was there a player that you grew up emulating or you grew up idolizing?
Henri was obviously huge for me, just because he was banging in goals left and right. And Patrick Vieira was playing a six, which I was playing at the time. So that was pretty cool for me as well.
Most people don't realize you've only been playing center back for a handful of years. You grew up playing actually as a midfielder.
Yep. My whole life, even through college, I was a center mid.
So as you're learning what it takes to be a midfielder, you want to emulate players like Patrick Vieira. What was it about those type of players that you said, I want to be like, I want to copy?
Well, he was a six. He was good on the ball. He was graceful, but he was also big. He's more of like a Yaya Toure build. You know, those guys for some reason always caught my eye. You know, their size, their strength, but their still ability to be graceful on the ball was really important for me to watch.
Now, not far from where you're from, there's a few guys like Nick Raimondo. There's Carlos Bocanegra. Is it true you actually attended one of Carlos Bocanegra's soccer camps?
Dude, I think I attended like the first four or five of their camps. It was an annual camp for Christmas, and the head coach of my team was Jimmy Nordberg at the time, who's great friends with Carlos Bocanegra, his brother Diego Bocanegra, Nick Raimondo. That's like a huge group of friends. That's like a SoCal brotherhood that those guys have. So they would host an annual Christmas camp, and I was at, yeah, probably the first, I would say, at five minimum.
How old were camps. You?
I was probably in that 13 to – no, probably like 10 to 15 range. And then I even started coaching at those camps.
Oh, you started working for them as well.
I started working for them. Carlos wasn't there anymore. But, yeah, when I was in college, I started going to the camps and being a coach at that point.
I imagine Carlos would show up while you're an actual participant at these camps. What was Carlos like back then? What did you see in Carlos back then?
Oh, he was so fun, man. Those guys, like, that access almost isn't possible nowadays. If me and some of the guys at Red Bull or some of the National League guys wanted to just throw a camp, I don't know if there's logistics that allow that. You know, they could brand themselves. They could say like, hey, national team captain is going to be running this camp. And we could go and spend like 4 or 5 days with them, like hours upon hours, and really get to know them and bond with them. It was amazing, man.
You obviously grew up watching Carlos Bocanegra. Carlos is one of the best center backs to ever wear the crest. Is there anything about his game that you enjoyed, or is there anything about him as a person or player that you want to now emulate or take into your everyday field life?
I mean, just watching him in the biggest moments kind of step up and captain that national team was amazing. And then also his dominance on set pieces was something now that I can look back on and be like, wow, I definitely want to be that guy.
Carlos wasn't the biggest center back. Obviously you're not the tallest guy. You're not the tallest center back, but you use your body well. Carlos was the same. And you talk about that aerial presence. When did you start realizing maybe your size was coming into play in the equation?
Probably midway through my college seasons, I started getting some set piece goals, and as a six at the time, thinking like, wow, this is probably the closest I'm ever going to be to the goal is on set pieces. I really got to start capitalizing on these moments.
And, all right, before we get into what is high school, college, listen, I love your story. You seem like a very hardworking kid. Everybody I talk to just raves about your work ethic. I want to know off the field, what are some of the jobs that Aaron Long's had off the field?
Jobs, like real jobs?
Like real jobs, everyday real jobs, my man. Not kicking a ball, getting paid.
Okay, working camps, coaching camps, construction. Because USL only gets paid during the season. You don't get paid year round. So when right. I was on these USL teams, I would come home and I would work construction for my high school soccer coach, actually, at like Air Force bases near my house, and just get down, man.
Obviously, that can be both humbling and rewarding. When you're trying to be a professional soccer player, but then you got to pick up literally your bootstraps and you got to go to work. You're hauling gravel, you're pulling lumber, your construction work. What's going through your mind?
Yeah. I mean, at the time it's just like, listen, I need to be making money. I don't want to, you know, I can't spend 3 months in the off season, 4 months in the off season doing nothing. It's at a point where you're like, listen, I love the game, but you know, I'm going to have to wake up at 5 a.m. and learn how to provide for myself one way or another. So it is very humbling. And in those moments, you just wish you could be playing soccer and you wish you could be playing for, you know, year round for a first team somewhere. And I think that really drives you.
So we're now past high school. I think the only actual school who was recruiting you was UC Riverside, correct?
Yes, until I had a scrimmage, Arsenal versus the national team. I think it was the U18 or U17 national team. And I played really well, and UCLA talked to my coach after the scrimmage and wanted me on a visit, but I was already committed to UC Riverside at the moment. But yeah, so until then it was just
UCLA. You said no to UCLA because you already had something guaranteed with Riverside.
Yes. But there's more of that story. UC Riverside, the head coach is Junior Gonzalez, who's also very close-knit in that SoCal group that would attend all the camps with Carlos Bocanegra, and he was one of the coaches in all those camps. So that was a very good family friend of ours, and my family felt comfortable going like, you know, listen, he's offered you something, you've accepted it, you gave him your word, he's a family friend, he's going to take care of you, like this is the right choice.
So you play your years at UC Riverside, you play PDL as well. Come time to move on, you're not invited to the MLS Combine. What's going through your mind when you're not even invited to this showcase?
Yeah, it hurt, but it wasn't too big of a surprise because at the time, no one from UC Riverside had ever been invited to the MLS Combine. So there was a lot of hype leading into the end of that college season. Like, you might be the first one to get invited to the MLS Combine. This could be amazing. And then it didn't happen. So it's like, you know, we were almost expecting it. And at that point, that's when I really had to start going out, making my own highlight tapes and sending them to my agent and my coach and just random coaches in the MLS and hoping they would see them.
You made your own highlight tapes for your own agent.
Yes, I did. I cut it myself. I put the music. It's still on YouTube somewhere. My college highlight tape. Yeah, it's hilarious.
What was on that highlight tape?
Me as a six, like breaking up tackles and showing some decent footwork.
Okay, so we send these out to enough people where somebody actually pays attention, and not only do they draft you, but they ended up drafting you in the second round as the Portland Timbers. So you're not invited to MLS Combine, but they saw something in you.
Yeah, I think it was a mixture of, I guess, the highlight tape. They saw qualities that they thought would fit the system, and taking the word of my agent that I was a good player at the time.
Who was the coach at the Portland Timbers at this moment?
It was Caleb Porter.
It was Caleb Porter, and Caleb's obviously he's had different brands throughout his MLS career, but he's known for wanting to implement a good style of football, players who take care of the ball. So he saw something in you. You show up to camp, you're not guaranteed anything. This is your first team opportunity. You got guys like, I believe Michael Silvestre was still there.
I don't think so. I don't think he was there yet.
Okay.
I think he had left.
He had left. Okay. United player. Was Jorge Villafaña there as well?
Yes, he was.
Sueño was there. Darlington Nagbe, Will Johnson, guys like that, right?
Yep. Diego Chara.
So you're finally in a first team atmosphere, first team experience. What's that like?
Yeah, it's scary coming in as a rookie in college. You don't know the coaching staff. You didn't get to talk to them at the MLS Combine like most of the kids did. They got drafted. I got drafted with a couple GA kids, Generation Adidas players. So it's you really feel like the lowest on the totem pole going into that preseason.
So you're the lowest on the totem pole. Does that affect your confidence? Does it affect the way you play on the field? Are you playing like you know you can play? What's going on?
Yeah, I think I was playing with a little bit of a chip on my shoulder, and I ended up having a pretty good preseason. We went to Tucson and played in those preseason games, and I had a couple really good performances. And I think that's what ultimately earned my spot.
You know, really briefly, we're talking about Darlington Nagbe being on that team. Darlington Nagbe is now also somebody who you've played with in Major League Soccer against him. And I don't know if you've had camps with him in the national team, but that brings me to my question. Darlington Nagbe is one of the few guys that I've publicly heard say, I don't want to play with the national team right now. Not if it takes time away from my family. You as a current member of this pool, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I don't fully understand it. I specifically spoke to Giassi as soon as Darlington went to Columbus. I'm like, dude, if you do anything, you get Darlington to come to the national team because I think he's an unbelievable player. I think everyone in our generation thinks he's an unbelievable player and a crazy good talent. And he could only help the national team pool at this moment. So, I mean, we would all love to see him play for the team. And I don't know exactly his reasons. I know he's definitely a big family man, which we respect to him. But, yeah, I would love to have him on the team.
There are those, and I'm in this field as well, that think he's an exceptional talent, but he's a luxury piece. He's not necessarily a guy that's putting up statistics, assist, and goals. But he's not necessarily that – six, that guy who's going to recuperate the ball and always be the hard leg in the field. What is it that you see in him?
He's a guy that you can give the ball to in any moment in the game, and he's going to keep it for you. And I think that is undervalued right now. especially in the national team with being a possession-based team. I think that he would be instrumental in those moments when we're trying to build out of the back and keeping the ball.
Aaron, we're going to get to the national team, but you just said, especially being a possession-based team, there are those who feel maybe this national team shouldn't be a possession-based team. You've seen the pool. You've rubbed shoulders with those guys on the field. You've seen the type of players you have. Can you play a possession-based style?
Yeah, definitely. I think first and foremost, every team needs to have a system. And we don't want to be, you know, a group of guys without an identity. And I think that we've done a good job trying to develop that identity. And I don't think that that means that we can't change things when we play different teams. You know, we do play a high-pressing Mexico. I don't think that means that we have to play a possession-based game every time. And we've spoken about that as a group, and I think we're pretty clear about that right now.
Good. Let's go back to Portland. Things go well enough for you to sign with Portland, but not well enough for you to really get that first team playing time that you're looking for. These things happen. I've been involved in it myself. You get released. The Sounders look at you. You go down the road, literally up the I-5. You find yourself in the Seattle Sounders, from one great organization like Portland to another great organization like the Seattle Sounders. What are those first moments like with the Seattle Sounders and you're seeing guys like Clint Dempsey across from you?
Yeah, that was a crazy time, man. It's like you go from getting drafted and you're like on top of the world to going into camp where you're scared and then you make the team and it's like everyone sending you congratulations texts and you know, you're the man for 4 months, and then I get released and it's all everyone that was just sending you congratulations text is now like, you know, what happened? What's the problem? What are you going to do now? And I was lucky enough to go to the Sounders and I had went to the Seattle Sounders combine that year before getting drafted. So they had looked at me and they knew who I was. So yeah, when I signed with them, it was unbelievable. And I think the first game that we played after signing them, unofficial game, was against Tottenham at home. And they dressed me for that game and I got to sit on the bench. So imagine going from never being in the 18 with Portland to now being on the bench with Seattle playing against Tottenham and thinking like I could come into this game. It was crazy feeling, man. It was crazy.
I'm sure there was a sold out crowd as well. Seattle always has these unbelievable crowds. You're finally getting these first team, I guess, brushes or in hopefully minutes. You've got guys like Clint Dempsey, Chad Marshall, who's been a three-time MLS Defender of the Year, Roman Torres, who meant so much to Seattle, is very important in their first championship. You're finally where you want to be. What's missing?
Playing time. I think that's the only thing that was missing was playing time and a chance to step on the field. I remember being in training with those guys and having good trainings and training well enough to make the 18 on a couple moments, which was a first, cause I'd never did that with Portland. But like you said, this team was star studded, man. Ozzie Alonso.
That's your competition Martins, right now. Ozzie Alonso
and yeah. Gonzalo Pineda were the two in the middle at the time. Ooh, unbelievable players, right? Like Obafemi Martins and Clint Dempsey up top, Marco Papa on the wing. Like this was a star studded lineup. They ended up winning the Open Cup and Supporter Shield that year.
Right. This is one of their four Open Cup wins, I believe, for the Seattle team since they made Major League Soccer. Ozzie Alonso is obviously an institution in Major League Soccer. He's one of the best. He's arguably the best defensive midfielder to ever play in Major League Soccer. This is who you're competing against. You're not getting a chance. All you feel that you need are minutes, but they're not coming. You're getting older. You haven't played first team. What's going through your mind?
Just how do I do what I need to do to get on the field? And at that time, I think the best way for me to get on the field was to show them that I could go on the field in different positions because I knew that, trying to win a spot over Ozzie Alonso wasn't very likely. So that's when they started looking at me as more of a Brad Evans type. That's what Siggy had told me on a couple occasions. We see you as a utility player. You can play right back. You can play left back. You can play center back. You can play right mid. You can play center mid. So they really started bouncing me around, and that's when they kind of experimented with me a little bit with Seattle too.
You hear this Brad Evans type, and Brad's had an exceptional Major League Soccer career, and he's one of those exceptions. But the problem with sometimes with being the jack of all trades is you're a master of none. Did that cross your mind? Like, I don't want to be that guy. There are very select few that can make a career out of this.
In the beginning, it was like, you know what, if that's just going to get me on the field, no problem. And I put my head down and I tried to do it as the best of my ability. But it wasn't as easy for me as I thought it was going to be. with that Seattle 2 team, it was always like every day in training, you're a center mid for us. And then if we want to bring down a first team center mid player for this game, then you're going to play left back, you know, and we'll tell you 30 minutes before the game that you're not going to play center mid. So it wasn't really like they were trying me out in different positions. It was almost like I was filling holes, or at least that's what it felt like. So I did feel like a master of none at the time, and I wanted some security in my position.
What does that do for your psyche? What does that do for the player, the athlete's psyche?
It's tough. It's tough. You just want some feedback from the coaching staff at that point and telling you, like, look, this is where we think you're doing well. We see you here. This is your path to the first team. This is how you're going to get to where you want to be. But, you know, in some of those moments, you just kind of lost in the darkness, trying to have good games, hoping that the first team coaches are watching, but you just don't really know.
Well, luckily for you, there was a first team coach watching. He just didn't happen to be in Seattle. He happened to be all the way on the other side of the country in New York. Jesse Marsh, actually, you caught his eye. And you had a good season with Seattle with S2 in the USL, and you had a few offers. New York wanted to bring you in with the condition of you signing with their USL team and only playing center back.
Yes.
What's this like when this proposition is made?
So at the time, I hadn't fully transitioned into center back yet. In my head, I was still a center mid at heart. And I wanted going into that preseason was a chance with the first team, a chance to make a first team roster. And I was looking at a couple different MLS teams, and Red Bulls was the one saying, listen, we will definitely give you a first team trial. You'll be in with us from the start of preseason, but the only condition is you have to play center back full time. And I think if I hadn't had that year with S2 bouncing around everywhere, there was almost a sense of comfort knowing, like, you know what, I can go in there and I'll be a center back and I'll learn it and I'll master this position. And I think that kind of helped me with that decision.
How old were you at this moment when this is 2016 and USL Red Bull 2 come knocking? How old are you?
23 or 24, I think.
And in most places around the world, you should already be an established professional. And that's sometimes the problem with the sport in our country is there's those lost years. And I'm not saying the collegiate level is lost years, but they're not like the rest of the world. So you're almost playing catch up. Is that what you felt like?
I did. Going into that preseason, I did. I felt like, how am I going into preseason against college kids? I'm trying to win a spot at this point on the first team. So I'm going against college draft picks who have been playing center back for their whole life. And I'm trying to win a first team spot against center back, starting center backs in the MLS, and I've never played the position. Like, how does that work?
Is Matt Miazga still on this squad at this moment? Because I know this is around the time he had the transfer to Chelsea.
He had just left that offseason to Chelsea, I believe. He wasn't in preseason.
So that influences maybe your decision. Like, there's a spot open. Look what they've already done. There are eyeballs on them from Europe. This all influences your decision.
For sure, for sure. And I know that the average age of the center backs is a little bit older. Matt had just left. They're looking for young guys to come in. This is a system that rewards young players. All that's affecting that decision.
Obviously, Jesse Marsh has proven to be a special coach. I had him with the national team as an assistant coach. I can tell you personally what those Bob Bradley, Jesse Marsh, Sorber video sessions are like. Those knock on your door with a USB drive and they put it in your computer, your laptop, and now you have your strengths, your weaknesses, your opponents. Give us a glimpse of what a Jesse Marsh video session is like, because you've had many with him, and this is why you were a USL player.
Yeah, this is me getting called in after every single USL game as I'm walking into the locker room, whether I'm training with the first team or the second team that day, and I have to go in and sit with him for sometimes 10 minutes, sometimes 30 minutes, and watch all my clips from my games. But yeah, he's taking every little small detail into account. He's talking footwork. What if the ball would have went here? Why aren't your feet arranged so that you could have hunted that ball down? Like, why are you facing this way? Why are you the last one stepping the line when you should be the first one? Like, I mean, it's so much of leadership with Jesse. And I think he was really trying to develop me as a center back and as a leader at the time.
It's funny because I just interviewed Tyler Adams, and he credits Jesse Marsh for his leadership attributes. What is it about Jesse Marsh that he wants his team to have all these kinds of leaders?
I don't know. I think that he was a big time leader in his day, and he wants to see every player. He treats every player on his team the same. And I think that definitely almost makes, he almost wants every player to be the leader. of the team. And he's never going to tell like the young guy, hey, you know, listen to the older guys. He's going to say, why aren't you doing it? Why aren't you the one speaking up? And I think that definitely translated with Tyler, and he kind of grabbed that bull by the horns.
Yeah. I mean, you look at the team, Dax McCarty at that time, Sasha Kleshchen, Bradley Wright Phillips, some of the foreign guys who were on that team. And here you have Tyler Adams, who I believe was 17, 18 at the time, and guys on the field in front of the cameras in the public eye. And you're like, whoa, you're almost taken aback when you see this.
Tyler's crazy. Tyler's a different breed of human. I remember one game I don't know who we were playing, and he lost his guy on a set piece and they score a goal. And immediately after, I think 3 minutes after, so usually as a young player, you're like, oh, you know, my guy gave up the goal, or, you know, the set piece, it's my fault, perhaps, whatever. I think 2 minutes later, he sprints over to the sideline at Jesse and just starts screaming at Jesse about tactics and why are we not forcing the ball to the left, to their left center back, blah, blah, blah. Like, and then Jesse just turns around. He's like, he's right. He's right. I can't believe it. Like, how is his mind so, so strong? How does he not even think about his mistakes? He just moves on. Yeah, Tyler's just a different breed.
He is a different breed. I actually brought up the moment that you guys played CONCACAF Champions League versus Chivas. And Tyler's one of the most secure guys I've seen on the field, despite his young age. And he had a play where he gives up the ball in his own third, and Chivas comes right back down your guys' throat and ends up scoring. This is in Guadalajara. And I'm thinking this is going to affect him. I'm thinking this is it. And that was the only mistake he made that game. That was the only mistake he made that series.
Yeah, I remember that vividly. Yeah, Tyler doesn't care about mistakes, that's for sure. He'll make a mistake in training or in a game, and whether if Tim checking back and getting the ball in a deep spot and losing it, the next play he's right back in the same spot, and he's like, let me show you that I'll never do that again.
Aaron, you've seen this firsthand. Listen, I've been on the field, and we played you guys in preseason when I was in Toronto and Orlando, in Hollywood, Orlando, I believe, in some game, and this kid, we were going at it back and forth, and I'm thinking to myself, who is this kid, you know? I was, all right. But when you're his teammate and you're an older player and you have a teenager getting in your face, even though he's right, sometimes those players with that experience, those vets, they don't handle it the best way. Have you seen that firsthand?
No, not really. I think that at Red Bulls, it's preached so much, you know, that there is no star, that there is no like veteran, like, you know, you're not going to be the guy that no one can talk to. It's a very family oriented thing. And I think it stems with Jesse saying in video multiple times, like, Tyler, why are you not the one that's telling him to move up if you know he should move up?
Right.
Like, why? Cause you're younger. So after you hear that so many times, then when Tyler finally,
you understand.
One, yeah, it's like, yeah. Okay.
Well, okay. I'm fascinated by this Red Bull system. Explain to us who don't know the Red Bull system, who don't know the tactics, who don't know Jesse Marsh, just quite what it is.
Young, aggressive, energetic system, high press, flying around the field, suffocating your opponents, turning the ball over as close to the goal as possible and going directly to goal.
What does this mean for the center back? Because not only are you learning a different position, a new position to you, but you're learning a new way of playing said position for everybody.
Yeah. That was, I don't know if that gave me a leg up or it like set me back a little bit, because it's not just a normal center back position. Like when I did play center back for S2, where you're kind of in the middle of the park and you're organizing and shifting, it's extremely aggressive. And if your right back flies out to defend their outside back, then you're shifting all the way over to defend a winger. And it's a lot of shifting, a lot of moving, but I think it fits my attributes as a player.
You talk about your attributes as a player. I've spoken to a lot of people who know you, both on the national team and club level, ex-teammates and whatnot, coaches. People don't realize how fast you are. You're a very athletic individual. I don't want to ask where that comes from, but I want to ask, is it true that you had one of the faster times for Seattle when you played?
I don't know if I had one of the faster times, like the 30 or 40 meter or whatever it is that they tested at the time. But I'm sneaky fast for sure. I think I got a weird like grandpa form when I sprint, so people don't take it into account. But yeah, I can catch people for sure.
Okay, so now you're making your first team. You made your first team debut. I believe it was a CONCACAF Champions League game against a team from El Salvador, Alianza. Alianza, you're getting more comfortable within the team. You're finally getting first team reps, first team minutes. Everything kind of comes very quickly for you at Red Bull. It works for you. It comes together. You're now playing. You finally got your first team minutes. It's got to be a lot of satisfaction and emotion just running through you.
Yeah, actually, funny story. The first time I got those minutes in that Champions League game, I showed up late to the game. We took the wrong exit. Me and another friend, another rookie at the time, took the wrong exit, and we had to go through Newark. And we're just in deadlock traffic. We had to leave our car on a bridge, and one of the Red Bull employees had to run out to the car and get in the car so we could sprint to the stadium so we could make it in time for the check-ins with the refs. Jesse says nothing. Hey, you guys okay? Glad you're here. Play the game, win the game. And Jesse calls me, and I'm feeling amazing. Played Champions League, first team minutes, first time ever. Calls me to the middle of the field and rips me. I let my teammates down. I let the fans down. I let, you know, if we would have lost this game, like, he doesn't know what he would do to me. Like, lays into me like never before. So it's like the all-time high and all-time like, holy what did I just do?
You
like,
left your car on a bridge.
On a bridge. And a Red Bull worker in a polo had to run out and get in the car because we're just stopped dead in traffic in the middle of the road, and we had to sprint to the stadium.
How much time before game time was this that you actually got there?
10 minutes. No, 10 minutes before warm-up. Sorry, 10 minutes.
10 minutes. That's still ridiculous. 10 minutes before warm-up, yeah. You had to get changed. Jesse is smart enough to not want to mess with your psyche because he's going to use you anyways.
Yeah.
He lets you do your thing, and you play well, and then he rips into you.
Oh, my God. Like, I've never been ripped by Jesse before.
What are you feeling at this moment?
I'm feeling like, am I going to get cut? Like,
right.
That he signed me for this Champions League game. He just signed me that day, actually. So I think the window closed at 5 p.m. and I'm submitting my contract on my phone at like 4:35 p.m. Like, you know, like last minute, getting this done so that I can play in this game. And Jesse's like, hey, get it in. You're starting tonight. You got to submit it. I submit it. I get to the game. I'm late. And then it's just like, I just signed. Am I going to get cut? How's tomorrow going to look? It was crazy, man.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. So you have a great season. You're finally playing. Let's go move forward. You're finally playing for Red Bull. You have a very good season. You're establishing yourself as a very good defender. Well, all of a sudden, national teams creeping up. They're paying attention. So you go. I think it was 2018. You finally got called up for the national team.
Yes.
And this is the same year you were named Defender of the Year. You guys had won the Supporters Shield. You were best 11. You were part of the best defensive group in the league. Everything's coming together finally, Aaron.
Yep.
What are you feeling? I mean, you finally made it. Is this a I finally made it moment?
Not quite. It was almost like the trajectory at the time had been going uphill so much. It went from like getting released to now USL team to now USL championship and USL defender of the year to like making a first team. Then we win Supporter Shield. I'm named defender of the year that year. It was all kind of creeping together. And then once I got the call into the national team, it was almost like, please don't mess this up. You know, you've done so much so far and this is what you've been working for. Like, it wasn't like you've made it. It was like, now it's time to really dig in.
Right. Some people don't realize that. And I was interviewing Charlie Davies the other day, and we're talking about his comeback after his car accident and him finally playing. And when he started scoring goals again, and instead of that being like that satisfaction, sometimes when these good things happen, it's more a relief.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was relieved, and there was a lot of anticipation leading into that. Like, you know, are you going to get called into the camps? I had made a couple prelim rosters and not got called in, so that when I did get the email saying that I was coming into camp, it was actually a different circumstance. It was like, hey, we're going to bring Aaron in for the camp in New York because they were going to train on our fields. And he's going to train with us. And then we're going to travel to our next game. And we're not sure if we're going to bring him with us or not. Like, we're going to kind of assess him in that week of training.
What camp was this?
This was October camp, maybe September of 2018. Who did we play? I think the second game was against Mexico that Tyler scored the game winner. I believe that might have been
in Nashville.
Yeah, that might have been the next camp.
Okay, so these camps are obviously with Dave Sarakin. Obviously, Greg's not in at the moment. There's a very strange vibe at these camps. It's a very young team. Not a lot of people are giving you guys, I don't want to say credit, but the benefit of the doubt of starting anew. There's a huge negative vibe over the national team, but you don't care. You're finally in camp. What's your experience like?
My experience was, especially that first week, it's like it's almost a tryout. You know, it's not like, hey, you made it. Here's your invitation and you're here for the 2 weeks and, you know, come along and get dressed and suit out. It was like, hey, this is your 1 week trial to impress the head coach so that you can hopefully go on the plane to the next game. So it was a lot of nerves for me, but luckily I saw some familiar faces during that camp and it kind of calmed me down. And being at home in New York on our training fields helped a lot as well.
Did you go to Nashville?
I did.
So you're in Nashville. It's against Mexico. You obviously know you grew up in Southern California. You obviously know what the game means to a lot of Mexican Americans, to a lot of Americans, obviously. I'm sure you have friends who cheer for either both national teams or just the Mexican national team. So you know the importance of this game. What's your first taste of this rivalry like?
It was a weird vibe during that game. There's a lot of young players on both teams. Completely different lineups. There's no big named veterans from either team. I'm trying to think, was Michael Bradley there at that time? But I don't think he was.
No. It was Tyler Weston. Weston got injured. He came out. That was the center mid. I believe it was it was going to kill me. I can't remember his name, who came on and played very well after plays in Germany. Oh, it's going to kill me. But yes, Michael Bradley.
I should know as well, to be honest. Okay, so I'm trying to think of who's going to be the leader here. Is the tone going to be the same in these games where it's like a dogfight, where, you know, USA-Mexico game where, you know, they hate each other? And you didn't really know how it was going to start, but it almost finished that way with Matt and getting Linus into that tiff with – yeah, there we go. That, yeah, and the fans ate that up, and that's when the atmosphere really kicked off. And then Tyler's game winner just kind of sealed the deal for us.
Which kind of papered over some cracks, because that game – the scoreline wasn't really indicative of how that game went. You guys were struggling a bit.
Yeah, we were. We were on our heels a couple times. They had a couple good chances. They were in our box a couple times. It was a scary game, but we came out on top.
And you guys ended up winning. That's your first rush. I want to fast forward to the Gold Cup, because I want to go back to Mexico. Now, you had a very good Gold Cup. You were named part of the best 11. I believe you scored your first goal, or you had a goal or two during that Gold Cup. You played very well. You guys started showing flashes of maybe the team that everybody wants to see. And obviously you understand that there's this negative vibe or this dark cloud over the U.S. men's national team pool right now. And it's unfair because very few of you guys had anything to do with the last process or the last cycle. But it is what it is, and you guys are almost always behind the eight ball, at least in the public eye. You're going into this game, to this final against Mexico. Now you have Michael Bradley. Now you have the Jozy Altidores. Now you have these guys who have been there, done that against these opponents. What's it like to see them getting into the mental state of facing off against their biggest rival?
Yeah, that was much more like textbook what I would think in my head that going into that game was going to look like. When we won the semifinals against Jamaica, I don't think I've ever seen Michael or Jozy so happy in my life. Like, they came into the locker room like, USA, Mexico, let's go. Like, it was something I've never seen. And the next couple days leading into that game, it was like, yeah, this is what this is supposed to be like. This is the rivalry that I've grew up watching. This is why it's so important to a lot of my friends. It was amazing.
Obviously, these guys have been there. They've done that. Did they say anything to you, or did you see them pull guys aside, trying to get them to grasp the importance of this game?
No, I think that the way that they were acting showed the importance. And I think that we all wrapped our head around that very quickly.
Now, listen, this is from my notes, because, and this is my notes of that game. I remember after every game, I go back and I rewatch the game and I'll take notes. And this is my notes of this game. And I don't know if you feel the same way, but you guys should have won. You guys should have won that final. Now, listen.
We had chances, man. We had chances.
Here we go. Minute 5, Jozy body Salcedo through ball with Pulisic 1v1 with the goalkeeper. He misses. Minute 7, Ream long ball to Jozy. Jozy cuts up Moreno. He misses. Minute 16, Mexico has a chance. Minute 30, Paul Arriola has a chance, a 1v1. Minute 42, it was Mexico with a long distance chance. And then minute 47, another chance. Minute 50, another USA chance. So there's 5 chances for U.S. men's national team versus Mexico in a final. They don't go in. You're on the field. You guys are there. Obviously, as the game grows, so does your belief. Walk me through this.
Yeah, I think Mexico is a very good tactical team. They don't just have good players, but now with Tata at the helm of that, they're very good tactically. And I think as that game goes on, I think that the belief starts growing, and we all know that we can win. And I think if we put one of those chances away first, I think we do win. I think that Mexico has to get a little aggressive in their press, and then we can really start picking them apart with our possession and try to hit them on the counter a couple more times.
If you were doing that game over again, you'd implement the same tactics, same style, because it almost looked like in the second half you guys ran out of gas. By minute 65, 70, you guys were done physically.
Well, at what minute did they score? I'm trying to
– let's see. They ended up scoring – Dos Santos, 73.
Yeah, I do remember in the second half their pressure – their ability to build pressure against us was amazing. And they were sending it flying forward. And I think early in the first half, when we had a lot of chances, we were playing direct into Josie and kind of playing off him. And I think that we should have done that a little bit more in the second half. And we were really trying to pick him apart.
And that's really how you were effective. And listen, few nines in CONCACAF have the physical abilities with the clean feet that Josie Altidore possesses. Do you think sometimes maybe you stray away from that because you guys are, it's drilled into you how much possession you want and you don't want to abuse that?
No, I think that it's choices on the field that maybe we don't make the right choice because, you know, we do practice possession so much, but when it's not on, we're told to hit the nine and we're told to play off Josie. So I think it, you know, as a center back, especially, I think that's part of my job to know when to play when Mexico's giving us a little bit of space. And if they're all on top of us, then we got to play long.
You remember those guys on the field for Mexico? Who's the one guy that just gave you so much, like just gave you fits? You just said, this guy's a danger every time.
Oh man, there's so many. I would say their number nine at the time was
Raul Jimenez.
Yeah, I think that he was really good in hold up play for them. And he's not the biggest guy, he's not the fastest guy, but his movement is amazing, and he's very clean on the ball, and he knows how to get in the right spaces to make a center back think, should I step or should I drop?
If I recall correctly, the goal they scored, ball comes into him, and he ends up holding it and backheeling to Jonah on Jonah's left foot, I believe, and that's how he finished it off.
Yep. So it's plays like that. It's, you know, he's not Josie's size. He's not massive, but he's a good player, man. He's very good.
Let's talk about Europe, Aaron. You're a player that has garnered European interest close a few times. MLS rejected, I should say Red Bull rejected an offer from West Ham. They rejected an offer from Frankfurt and an undisclosed French team. One, it's great that you're getting these European offers, this interest from abroad. But two, it must be frustrating knowing that they're not being accepted. Your European dream's still on hold.
Yeah, a little bit. I think the best thing that helps with those frustrations is just trying to be transparent in those moments, transparent with the club, and the club being transparent with me. And I think that really smooths over those situations and makes them go a lot easier.
Obviously, somebody who was very transparent was your agent at the time, who on social media kind of lashed out and said, they're asking for $15 million for Aaron. It's absurd.
Yeah. I don't want to speak to that because I don't want to discuss actual numbers, but in terms of transparency, it's like, listen, guys, this is a dream of mine. You know, I would love for you to make it possible.
Right.
And Red Bulls is saying, listen, we need a fair offer. And they don't think that they got that at the time. So I guess we just have to move on.
You're a pretty honest guy. So I want to ask you, can Aaron Long play in Europe?
Yeah, absolutely.
At what level can Aaron Long play? Where do you see yourself playing? Give me, is it La Liga? Is it the Bundesliga? Is it Serie A? What type of brand of football do you see yourself playing?
I think the interest that I've got from the scouts from different clubs is that I could play in the Bundesliga and I could play in the Premier League. I think those are two leagues that fit my attributes as well as a big, strong, fast center back and decent with my feet.
Now, Aaron, you've played against a lot of different players, whether it's club or country. So this question almost goes back to the Raul Jimenez question. Who's that player anytime you face is just, this is the guy that's too much. And I don't want to say maybe too much for you, but you're like, I got to tip my hat off to this guy. This guy's something else.
Oh, that's a good question. I've faced some, some pretty good strikers. I'd say David Villa.
David Villa. Over Zlatan, over Jimenez, Chicharito, Joseph Martinez, Vela. It's David Villa.
Yep. I don't think I've faced like Vela, a lot of the West Coast guys as much. I only see him once a year. Zlatan, I only played once. Actually, I played twice. I played him once there, once at home. But David Villa, the amount of times that I saw him, you know, two, three, sometimes four times a year. If I get him in Open Cup or I see him in playoffs, it's
and
like
he's a rival. What was it about him? What was it about him?
I mean, one, that he's an unbelievable player, that he shows up in big moments. They're all rivalry games when I play him, so he's ready to play. His ability to hurt you in different ways, whether it's off the dribble or shooting from distance, walking around for 10 minutes like he's not in, like he's not into the game, and then he'll just spring forward on a run on your weak side and you don't see him. Yeah, I think just as many, many ways he can hurt you as a player.
Now, we're going to do this little dynamic. I'm going to ask you a series of questions, and I want your most honest answers. Sometimes I want the first answer that comes to your head, okay? We're going to talk about CONCACAF's best. In your opinion, you've seen these guys, you've played against them, whether it's in MLS or national team, and maybe sometimes from afar. But who is CONCACAF's best player at the moment? We have Raul Jimenez, we have Christian Pulisic, we have Keylor Navas, we have Alfonso Davies, and we have Carlos Vela.
Ooh, it's definitely between Vela, Pulisic, and Alfonso Davies. But I'm going to say, I think Carlos Vela is so seasoned in his career. And as a player, he knows exactly who he is and what he can do to hurt people. So, but I think if you give Christian a year or two, I think that he tops them all.
We're all obviously very high on Christian Pulisic. You see him day in, day out when you're with the national team. Why is he so good? What about him makes him so good?
Yeah, he's so tidy in tight spaces. His acceleration, and it's not just his top speed. It's like quickness and top speed mixed together. I think Michael Bradley described it as like light. Like it's almost like a Landon Donovan, how light he is on his feet. And yeah, the way he can dribble around defenders and make it look effortless is crazy, man. It's something I've never seen before.
Okay, and we have we're going to call this one a defender's worst nightmare. From the national team, the current team, the current pool, who has the best shot?
Best shot. I mean, can I put Josie in there? Because he's got
Of course, Josie.
Yeah, Josie's on
there.
Yeah, I would say Josie.
Okay. Best dribbler?
Christian.
Best header? You can include yourself.
Ooh. I mean, I'm up there for sure. Offensive, like on corners?
Yeah.
It's got to be me or Walker.
Walker Zimmerman. All right. Who's got the best vision?
Michael Bradley
has the best vision. Who's strongest on the ball?
Josie.
And who's the biggest pest?
I can't see him pushing him off, yeah. The biggest pest, Tyler Adams.
Tyler Adams is the biggest
100%,
pest.
100%.
All right. Last thing, you're obviously high on Josie and Michael Bradley. One, what's your opinion on this negative vibe or reaction these two get? And two, how important or are they vital to the national team today?
I mean, the negatives are pretty obvious, that, you know, that they were involved in us not qualifying. But I mean, if you look at what they have done for the national team and what they have done for the country, it's amazing. And what the amount of games that those guys have put in, the amount of special moments that they've created either personally or been a part of, it's insane, man. And some of those moments are engraved in my head. So I'll always tip my hat off to those two. And what was the second question you asked?
Do they still have a place in the national team?
Yeah, for sure. I think just taking Gold Cup as an example, you need leaders and guys that have been there before and guys that can set the tone and guys that you can lean on in moments that are either tough or moments that you haven't been through. And I think there's a lot of guys right now that are young and new to this pool. Even if they are experienced and playing at top levels, like Christian and Tyler and Weston and all these players, you know, I don't know if any of those guys had been to a Gold Cup yet, and making it to a final and seeing Josie and Michael's reactions, you know, going into Mexico and seeing how fired up they were, and how you knew it was going to be a brawl and almost a fist fight to the death, is how they're making it seem like you need guys that have been there in those moments to look at and to know and to understand what's coming.
Well, Aaron Long, thank you so much for being with us, man. I wish you nothing but the best. Appreciate your time.
Of course. Thanks for having me.